Hey everyone, I'm Dan Kortler, the host of TED Climate. Each episode, we unpack the problems and solutions of climate change. This season of the show, we're getting into some big ideas that make us optimistic about the future, like meat grown from cells and leather made from mushrooms. And the best part? We look at how building a greener future can be an upgrade instead of a sacrifice. Find and follow TED Climate wherever you're listening to this.
This is a CBC podcast.
That sound. Uh-oh, that sounds like snow. That sounds like winter. Molly, where are you taking me?
Yeah, I mean, it's not uh-oh. This is fun. I'm taking you to Banff National Park, Laura. I was there in February, and there was a little bit of snow on the ground, but people I spoke to said it was actually very minimal snowpack this year.
Well, we know that that kind of thing is affecting all sorts of places. And we know the ski hills around Vancouver have been having real struggles with getting enough snow to keep people on the hills. So it's been difficult.
Yeah, I mean, it's not just the ski hills. Climate change is altering snow, ice, and glaciers that draw 4 million visitors to Banff National Park every year. And all of that tourism relies on these iconic sites, you know, the snow-capped peaks. But some of the activities that people are doing are actually changing as the glaciers have been retreating more and more rapidly.
And I have actually seen, and I think you've been with me, on at least one glacier that we saw retreating, and it is hard to see things changing like that, but I imagine for the people who work and play in those areas, it must be really hard too.
Oh yeah, it's not just like the scientists that are observing these changes, right? Like these changes to these iconic Canadian landscapes are affecting mountain guides in particular. They're experiencing some of these dangers, these hazards that warming winters are creating. So these can be guides that take people high up in the Alpine on snow, rock, and ice to do different things, whether that's, you know, skiing or climbing. These are people who make a living in the mountains, and they are learning how to adapt.
Okay, well, that is Molly Siegel, listeners out there. She is a producer on our show. I'm sure you've heard her voice before. I'm Laura Lynch. This is What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. Okay, Molly, let's head on into the mountains.
If you flip through the guest books from Abbott Pass Hut in Banff National Park, you'll find any number of stories like this one.
July 6, 7th, 2009, 3 hours of heavy rain brought the approach gully to life. Lots of rockfall off Victoria. Don't dawdle. One unfortunate fellow got hit by a large boulder the size of a goalie's hockey bag when it was full of pads.
Yes, I do remember that event, and I was heading up to Abbott Pass. But this chunk of rock was a number of cubic meters. So it came down and stapled this guy, basically pressed him.
And he broke a tooth, bloody lip, with tooth fragments embedded in it. And he was heli-evac'd from Abbott Pass.
I think that day we had moderate rain. So it was something I've ticked off of my guides list, that if it's ever moderate or heavy rain, I won't go into that gully, because it's too much rockfall. I'm Barry Blanchard. I live in Canmore, Alberta. I am a internationally certified mountain guide.
My name is Kate Hanley. I'm a PhD candidate at the University of Calgary in the Geography Department, and I'm studying the vulnerability and adaptability of mountain guides to climate change.
Kate's research has taken her through all of the entries in those guest books from Abbott Hut. Well, all of the entries that weren't eaten by mice or burned by mountaineers as kindling. And she's found that stories like the one Barry remembers became more common in later years as the Rocky Mountain glaciers were receding. In the world of Canadian mountaineering, Abbott Pass is famous. And you may not think you know where it is, but I bet you've probably seen a photograph of the very glacier that receded under the foundations of Abbott Hut. That iconic postcard view of Lake Louise, you know, with the craggy peaks and that glacier in the background. Abbott Hut was built in 1922 with rocks from the mountain by Swiss guides who made the steep journey up from the back of Lake Louise.
This is going down Abbott to Lake Louise. I think this was like 1920s. It's very different now. It's pretty wild how different they look. You can see like the glacier comes all the way down almost to where the Plain of Six Glaciers trail would start, and now it's like way up there.
The contrast between the 1929 and the 2022 photos is stark. The glacier nestled between the two mountains at the back of Lake Louise looks like it'll soon be out of view. The route up Abbott Pass from Lake Louise is sometimes called the Swiss Guide's Route, or the Death Trap.
I think because a donkey died going up there originally. I don't remember now, but it kind of feels a bit like a death trap these days.
To try and measure the impact climate change is having on mountain guides in the Rockies, Kate looked at data illustrating how glaciers and temperatures have changed, and what all of that means for people who explore those peaks. And that information lives here. Over the course of nearly a century of guest books, or registers,
you start seeing more and more people going up throughout the registers. Like, this is the first... this is the first time they went up in July, whereas like in the later dates, people are going up in the spring to ski some of these mountains.
Kate found in her research that when glaciers melt, they reveal new hazards to people guiding and exploring.
Rising temperatures, it's been well established that they're one of the primary drivers of glacier retreat. And glacier retreat is one of the biggest factors in rockfall. Was as glaciers retreat, or semi-permanent snow and ice kind of retreats backwards, it exposes rock that hasn't seen the light of day for a really long time. And if it's on any kind of slope, it becomes really unstable.
Rockfall has been one impact of the retreating Victoria Glacier. But the hut was also compromised. In 2016, there were reports that the hut was unstable. And there were some years of assessments and plans to try and save it. But then the summer of 2021 hit.
The 2021 heat dome, where we experienced that significant intense heat throughout the summer in Western Canada, just was the nail in the coffin. The glacier had retreated enough at that point that the rate of retreat started increasing. And once that darker surface of soil and dirt and material was exposed, it could absorb enough heat that the permafrost underneath just thawed and it eroded.
In 2022, Parks Canada dismantled Abbott Hut. There's a memorial now where it used to be. Barry is one of the guides Kate talked to for her research. He started guiding groups to Abbott Hut and the surrounding mountains in the early 1980s.
You know, culturally, the loss of that hut, it's a grandfather for mountain culture in Western Canada.
Cultural loss is actually something that even UNESCO has noted, recognizing mountaineering in the European Alps as a threatened activity.
Rising temperatures are generally causing glacier retreat and the loss of snow and ice, so that has pretty big implications on any guided or recreational activities that rely on those kinds of environments.
Besides rockfall, Kate also says receding glaciers can lead to increased risk of avalanches at lower elevations. It also makes routes more challenging, often forcing people to navigate ice instead of snow, for example.
It's just generally changing the landscape pretty quickly. And for guides, that's super significant.
So I'll give you a very concrete example.
This is Ian Wellstead. He's climbed in Canada's Rockies for 3 decades, and in more recent years has worked as an alpine guide. 3 years ago, he was out on Mount Athabasca in Jasper National Park on the Icefields Parkway, an area that's world famous for its glaciers. He was using elevation to establish where he was with his GPS.
But I hadn't thought that, the map on my GPS is 20 years old. And so the elevation that I was triangulating, I was using it as one of the data points to figure out where I was. And of course, I was a few hundred meters lower than where the map said I would be because the glaciers receded so much.
Routes that he and other guides have relied on historically are starting to become unrecognizable or even off limits.
I think this is where we have to be really flexible. If people still want to recreate and get out in the mountains, we can't just rely on the old things that we've done. The guiding community is quite tight-knit, and so there's a lot of information exchange. And really, one of the main things we do is talk to other guides or other people, really.
We'll hear more from Ian later. So how are mountain guides adapting to the new risks that climate change poses on the terrain they travel on? In her interviews with 30 guides, Kate Hanley documented a few key ways they're managing to take people out.
I'd say the most common way is just changing what time
you're climbing, so you might be starting earlier in the day or earlier in the season. They also adapt by just changing where they're climbing. So, for example, if Mount Athabasca is increasingly out of shape and it's just not a safe option, they can find another location to guide in, assuming their clients are willing to adapt with them. And sometimes it's not used very common, but you just change the activity you're doing in general, where it's like, you know, alpine climbing is just not going to happen. The conditions are too dangerous. So you go rock climbing instead.
Changing the time, location, and activity are the main ways guides are adapting to a warming climate. And it's not just high alpine expeditions that are affected. Even at lower elevations and on gentler terrain, guides are noticing a change.
I think, this is snow. And before it was just dirt, right?
Oh, I just thought there would be ice under here at this time of year.
Normally there would be. I'm Tim Patterson. I own and operate Zootman Guiding, and I'm originally from Merritt, British Columbia, Lower Nickel Indian Band. The company is basically bringing Indigenous knowledge and Western knowledge and guiding together and making some sense out of the world, right? And some of it is around climate change and ecology and all that, but a lot of it is how Indigenous knowledge of the mountains works or doesn't or is different.
It's a sunny day in February when Tim and I meet up at a trailhead for a winter hike in Banff. And usually this time of year, he'd be more likely to take people out on snowshoes. But today, spikes attached to the bottom of our boots will do.
Really, it's snowshoeing and just hikes like this with micro spikes, especially lately with the type of snow that we've been having. It's been kind of hard to snowshoe.
He's planning on taking a group here this week, so we're doing a bit of reconnaissance while we chat and walk. And there is some snow on the ground today. But a couple of weeks ago, he was on a hike just east of Banff.
And it was 15 degrees. And there was no snow, and it was supposed to be a snowshoeing trip. And we were dealing more with mud than we were dealing with snow. And, you know, taking layers off rather than putting them on. People were just like, this is crazy. This is January and it's 15 degrees in the mountains, you know.
Whether he wants it or not, climate change impacts his work all year round, from the activity he picks for his clients to the type of gear he brings. But when the conditions are unusual for a certain time of year, climate change naturally comes up.
You know, the weather generally, like people just start talking about the weather. It's one of the things that Canadians do well.
We also love to talk about the impacts that the weather is having.
Typically when it's really hot and you're in the alpine, you get that really sweet smell of the subalpine fir. And where that's coming from is that the sap is warm enough that it starts melting. And same with the bark and the needles. Typically you smell that in late to mid-August, and last year in mid-June, we were smelling it then. It gives you an indication of the heat, which normally happens a lot later. It's things like that that you notice and people notice and they ask about.
It's a way to open up a conversation.
It's how do you talk about complexity or talk about, you know, sensitive issues with a wide group of people, right? And it's, you know, not beating people over the head all the time with the climate's changing, you have to do something. And I think for a long time people were nervous of that. You know, if you've been out any length of time, you get to see that it's changing and that's kind of what's happening, so like it or not, right?
Between 6 and 8 guides work with Tim at any given time, and figuring out the best way to address climate change with clients can be tricky.
What I tell people, my guides and my customers as well as fellow guides, is that, you know, we're not here to change anything in terms of people's behaviors or whatever. We're guides. We're taking people into the mountains, right? And, but if we can help them understand what is happening in our mountains, you know, and let them come to the conclusion.
This season, it's just becoming much more variable. I think that would be the way to sum it up, that it's becoming more and more difficult to plan ahead because we just don't quite know what's going to happen.
Alpine guide Ian Wellstead.
This year, it seemed like it went from this minus 45 to 15 degree above rock climbing within a week or so, which I think is quite unusual.
Normally, Ian wouldn't be taking people alpine climbing in the winter, but this year there are some routes that were open. Even though there's less snow and ice in the Rockies than usual, he says this year there has still been more of it here in Canada than the U.S.
Definitely the Canadian Rockies are getting busier for ice climbing specifically. I think a lot of Americans are coming up because it's just they don't really have dependable ice conditions. For example, a friend of mine was just running the American Guides Association ice component of certification for American guides in the Canadian Rockies. So it's the American guides have to come to Canada to make sure that they actually have some ice to climb.
Which gives Ian hope that despite the ways he and others have to alter their plans, there will still be ways for people to explore the outdoors. One of the solutions to doing that safely could be equipping not just mountain guides, but everyone venturing into the mountains with more information about climate change, and how that is altering the conditions. Here's Kate Handley.
Distilling the knowledge of guides into decision-making tools or courses for recreationalists who still want to get out there would be a really valuable tool, potentially.
In other words, a course about climate hazards in the mountains, sort of like how you can take a course on avalanche safety. She says having reports on mountaineering conditions in the summer months would be helpful as well. And some of the guides she spoke to also say they want a more flexible system for permits in the national parks. Each national park has its own permit, and Kate says guides need to include which specific routes they want to take people on. So one approach is to add all potential routes when guides get the permit months in advance.
Because then if you get to the day where you're supposed to guide a client and the route that they want to climb that's in a national park is just not safe. The issue is that climate change is making access to certain locations increasingly restricted and limited because of increased hazards. And then this is just another barrier on top of that that seems to be limiting guides' ability to kind of adapt by changing where they're climbing.
I reached out to Parks Canada by email. They replied and said they're engaged with and will continue to work with the Association of Canadian Mountain Guides on their approach to permitting. There are tangible ways to adapt, at least up to a point. But there is also tangible loss. Kate shares an entry from one of the guest books from Abbot Hutt's later years.
This one's pretty poignant, from August 13th, 2015. This place is very beautiful. Hopefully many people will continue to enjoy the view for many years to come. I am 11, climbed Mount Victoria yesterday, and I feel very sad that global warming is destroying the Rockies.
It's a tough thought that kids won't experience the same alpine documented in the old hut registers. And there are other, perhaps more intimate, losses.
This one had a good drawing of the outhouse at Abbot Hut. It's a big deal. Where is it?
Or maybe it was in being remembered for having one of the most scenic outhouse views, perhaps in the world.
There's a book called Poo with a View, I think. And they named the outhouse at Abbott Pass to be the crown jewel of outhouses in the Canadian Rockies. And it's just like wild. But getting there, it's a pretty narrow ridge. You're surrounded by like cliffs or super tall mountains.
Kate has her own memories from the famous Abbott Hut outhouse.
I remember personally when my dad and I were up there, we waited until the other one had to pee in the middle of the night so that we could hold hands and go
to brave the narrow ridge together.
So many challenges to mountaineering, but poo with a view, who could resist that, right? I'd love to see some photos of the view from the Abbott Hut if anybody wants to send them in, earth@cbc.ca, or any other spectacular views from the Rockies, because there are so many of them. I have enjoyed hikes up there, and it is such a special place. So thank you for that, Molly. So, do you know what the second largest source of emissions in Canada is? Anyone? Okay, well, I know we've got some climate savvy listeners, so I'm betting many of you do know the answer. It is transportation. And we've talked a lot about EVs on the show and a little bit about trucking, cycling, and even flying and water travel. Then there's public transit. We asked you for your thoughts about this, and you wrote to us about buses, trains, and trams. And what on earth? Rachel Sanders is here now with some of your emails. Hi, Rachel.
Hey, Laura. Yes, there is a lot of love for public transportation out there. Sean Ledoux wrote from North Bay, Ontario, to say, as a chronic environmentalist and anti-pipeline activist, I was painfully aware of the hypocrisy in still driving my fossil fuel car. When the pandemic began, it seemed like a great opportunity to do the right thing and leave off of my car-centered life. I started by buying a bus pass and downloading a taxi app, all while leaving the car parked in the driveway just in case. Any trepidation I had quickly left once I realized just how freeing and transformative the move would be. Between walking, rollerblading, cycling, public transit, taxis.
Rollerblading?
Rollerblading.
As commuting?
As commuting, apparently, yeah. In North Bay.
Okay.
And vehicle rental when absolutely needed. I'm thrilled with my new arrangement. The added exercise keeps me in top shape and with plenty of mood-enhancing brain chemistry. The money saved is profound, and I don't have to smell exhaust fumes while scraping a windshield. Sean says he'll never own a car again, not even electric. He doesn't think it's sustainable for everyone to own one. And all he wants now is a government grant to help with the purchase of an e-bike.
I've actually been noticing a lot more people getting e-bikes, using e-bikes to a greater and lesser extent. Even our senior producer, Catherine Rolfson, has an e-bike. And I have a friend who uses his e-bike to go grocery shopping. He attaches a wagon behind it, puts his groceries on it. He's an evangelist about e-bikes. And I actually was talking to you yesterday and suggesting that maybe you should get one.
Yeah, I'll think about it. I'm not sure I'm brave enough, but I'll keep it in mind. Yeah.
Okay, that's the urban experience. But here is another perspective. Roger Moore writes, I live in a small town near Kamsack, Saskatchewan. Saskatchewan used to have a provincial bus system, but it was taken away. Now we have no provincial bus system at all. I live 12 kilometers from the nearest grocery store, so I cannot take public transit at all. Now, Roger says he used to live in Victoria, BC, and he took transit all the time. And he can see how people in urban areas might be able to manage without a car completely.
Right. So we've heard now about the urban experience and the rural experience. Let's hear about a suburban transit experience. Anne Rain lives in a small commuter town outside of Ottawa that has no public transit left at all. They had a rural commuter service, but it died during the pandemic. And now that more people are working from home, she doesn't think it's coming back. But Anne still finds a way to take transit about 3 days a week, and it is so complicated. She borrows her mom's car, drives 30 kilometers to a park and ride, and then she takes a bus to the nearest functioning O-train station, and then she takes a train the rest of the way to work.
I noticed that she said functioning O-train station. I think I've read quite a few stories about issues with the O-train, so but I gotta say, she seems to be doing more than anyone else, I think, would do to use public transit instead of a car.
She is so committed. Yeah. Anne said, ridiculous as it is, I still like this complicated transit route better than driving all the way to work. I feel more relaxed and more connected to the world when I take transit, in addition to saving money. And I'm also hoping my tiny contribution will help maintain demand for what service we do have. Anne wishes the province would subsidize this kind of commuter transit service instead of widening roads. She writes, if we build systems that incentivize driving, that's what people are going to do. We have to denormalize private car ownership. It's such a wasteful way to organize our economy and built environment.
And haven't we heard that before? We've also heard from a lot of people about their favorite transit systems around the world.
That's right, yes. And I'd love to hear some more of those kinds of stories. We'll be including some of them on our show next week when we bring you more stories about making public transportation awesome.
Well, that's awesome. Mm. And I'm going to keep my opinions about best transit system to myself for now. But you, please email us anytime to tell us yours, earth@cbc.ca. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks, Laura.
Paper or plastic?
Oh, I forgot my own bags. Plastic. No, wait, paper. Hang on, which one's better? I don't know.
Don't stress, Neil. The podcast Living Planet is here to help. We know you want to do what's right for the planet, but you're busy and you have to make 1,000 small decisions every day. So we endeavor to answer, what's better?
Cotton or polyester?
Tea or coffee?
For answers to these environmental conundrums and your questions, subscribe to Living Planet wherever you listen to podcasts.
I'm Laura Lynch, and you're listening to What on Earth, where we bring you a world of climate solutions. After weeks of being on the road instead of in their fields, thousands of farmers in northern India have made it to the nation's capital. They're in New Delhi to deliver a message. They're demanding the government guarantee prices for their crops. And Vivian, this is a huge international news story, but it's also a climate story, right?
Yes, it is, Laura. And, you know, there are a lot of issues at play here. Politics, labor, human rights. But there is another big reason why there's so much at stake for India's huge population of farmers. They're among the most vulnerable farmers in the world when it comes to climate change. And some of the changes they want could actually help them adapt.
Okay, well, for listeners, that's Vivian Lux. She's a producer on our show. And I should note, because the story is developing quickly, things are changing fast, that you and I are actually speaking on Friday, March the 15th. So, Vivian, bring us up to speed. What's been happening in India?
So, in mid-February, farmers in rural areas of Punjab and Haryana states began making their way to New Delhi. They were traveling in tractors, trucks, scooters, and even on foot. They did pause along the way for talks between the government and union leaders. And for weeks, authorities also tried really hard to keep the farmers away from the capital. They barricaded highways, they used tear gas and fired metal pellets to disperse the crowds, they restricted internet access, things even became deadly at one point. But just days ago, the farmers were allowed into New Delhi, so long as they left their farm vehicles and their sticks and swords behind. So instead of arriving in their tractors, the farmers rode on buses and trains.
But why were the authorities trying to stop the farmers from entering the capital in the first place?
Well, this latest showdown is actually a continuation of the protests that rocked India in 2021. So back then, the government said it was trying to modernize the sector by introducing some new laws. But farmers were worried about losing income. So in that protest, there were tens of thousands of people camped outside the capital for more than a year. Eventually, the government backed down. But it's been 3 years now, Laura, and farmers complained the government still hasn't taken one critical step, which is guaranteeing prices for a variety of crops, and hence this second protest.
Okay, but why is that so important, and what exactly does that mean to guarantee prices?
So right now, the government sets a minimum price for wheat and rice. This protects the two crops from ups and downs in the market, but other crops don't get similar protection. And so even though there are other things that the farmers are demanding from the government, their main ask now is for guaranteed crop prices because the cost of fuel, fertilizers, and other things have gone way up in recent years.
But crop prices have not been rising the same. In fact, they've been quite volatile. And so for many farmers, it's now really not financially viable to cultivate.
That's Jayati Ghosh. She's an economics professor at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. She's back home now in New Delhi this term, and she's been keeping an eye on the protest. And she says without the minimum price guarantees for more crops, farmers in India may not survive.
Okay, you've set this all up really well. I understand everything that is at stake for the farmers and what the government's trying to do. And it's also happening against the backdrop of an upcoming election. But what does all of that have to do with climate change?
Well, before we get into that, I think we need to make clear just how significant the farming sector is in India, and especially in Punjab. Roughly two-thirds of India's people depend on agriculture for their livelihood. In the 1960s, the government designated the northeastern part of India, which includes the state of Punjab, as its breadbasket. This was considered at the time the most fertile part of the country because several rivers flow through it. So during this green revolution, farmers got cheap loans to buy heavy machinery. The government also invested in high-yielding crops, chemical fertilizers, and irrigation techniques.
And because of this support mechanism linked to the Green Revolution, the yields of wheat and rice increased 4 and 3 times since 1960.
That's Bashir Singh Sidhu. He teaches at the Institute for Resources, Environment, and Sustainability at the University of British Columbia. And he says that because the production of wheat and rice was so successful, farmers started mostly just growing only those two crops. And they moved away from other things like millets and hardy cereals that are indigenous to the region and that require a lot less water to cultivate. And so this practice just continued along with the support prices for rice and wheat.
Okay, I'm starting to get the link now. And I think I'm understanding this. The more the government protected those two crops, the less incentive the farmers had to grow those other more sustainable things.
Yes, and the more water they used. So now, according to Jayati Ghosh, the farmers are finding themselves in a bind. And that's why they're demanding price guarantees for crops other than just rice and wheat.
They say that, if you do this, we will diversify. At the moment, we are growing rice in places that we shouldn't grow rice. And it's depleting the water table. Because we know at least we will get that price for it. If you provide the minimum support price, we will diversify into better crops, more sustainable crops, and better types of cultivation.
Now, I thought Punjab was supposed to have this abundance of water, though. There are all these rivers flowing through it. That's why it became the birthplace of the so-called Green Revolution.
That's right. The name Punjab actually means the land of five rivers, except some of those rivers are diverted to neighboring states. Also, Bashir says that over the years, there have been things like subsidies and free electricity and cheap loans to buy machinery. So farmers have actually been incentivized to pump groundwater to cultivate. The problem is, again, rice and wheat are such thirsty crops that farmers are finding it harder and harder these days to get water out of the ground.
If your neighbor is digging 300 feet into the ground and they start pumping, then that also impacts your access to groundwater, so you have to dig even deeper.
And because groundwater use isn't metered, Bashir says whoever can get to it first can just use as much as they want. And those who can't dig as deep, they have to depend on canals and rivers to irrigate the lands, which wouldn't be so much of a problem if it wasn't for the intense drought and heat waves and changing rain patterns that have been made worse by climate change. The extreme weather is really affecting harvests. And things have gotten so bad that in 2022, the IPCC, so the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, it identified India as one of the most vulnerable nations for crop production. And that vulnerability doesn't just hurt farmers and the food available within the country. It also affects global food supply chains because, of course, India exports a lot of its products too.
Does that include Canada?
Yes, it does. Well, Canada imports some food products from India, like rice, for example. But it's not just trade that ties what's happening in India now to Canada. We have a large Indian diaspora here, and people are paying attention to the farmers' protests overseas. One of them is Moninder Singh. When he first heard that farmers in India were protesting again, he said one thing immediately came to his mind. It was something that the now deceased actor and activist Deep Sidhu said.
Which means that this is a generational fight.
Mm-hmm. Moninder speaks for the BC Gurdwaras Council. He has family in Punjab, and he says one of his cousins has even been marching in the protest. Moninder himself, though, he was born and raised here, and he's only ever been to Punjab once when he was 3 years old. And yet, he feels a deep connection to what farmers there are going through, and he says he's not the only one.
For some reason, even people like me have there's an affinity and this love for the land that where we come from, that that's just been kind of, we've grown up around between the culture, the music, the language. So we're kind of tied to it in that way. So you see a lot of young people that are born and raised in Canada very impacted by this as well.
Last month, the BC Gurdwaras Council and Ontario Gurdwaras Committee appealed to the federal government. They want Canada to condemn India's crackdown on protesters. And Moninder says some of his members are even sending money overseas to organizations that are giving out food and other basic necessities to farmers on the march.
This truly is a generational fight for the people of Punjab. And status quo will lead to their pretty much the annihilation of Punjab's agriculture if they don't do something soon about it.
Moninder did mention, though, Laura, that people here in Canada have to be very careful about sending money overseas because they're afraid of repercussions from the Indian government.
Okay, well then how has the Indian government been responding to the protests?
Well, at some point during the protests, the government did offer to guarantee prices for 5 crops over the next 5 years. But the farmers rejected that offer. They say it's not enough. They want price guarantees for even more crops. And India's agriculture minister responded at the time by saying discussions should continue and a solution needs to be found peacefully.
Now, I heard Moninder talking about what farmers in India are doing to fight for their livelihoods. But what are people saying the government should do to protect those livelihoods from the impacts of climate change?
Well, we already talked about how guaranteeing prices could encourage farmers to plant more diverse crops. But here's what else Jayati Ghosh wants to see.
We need much more research into the kinds of crops that will be more resilient. We need much more in terms of spreading the information about those to the farmers. We need to give access to better, more sustainable inputs. And so especially the smaller farmers, they end up paying higher prices, but they also go for the cheaper, often more adulterated versions and very heavy chemical, often poisonous kinds of chemical usage. Or they don't go in for natural fertilizers because those are quite expensive. Then there's the whole use of water. There is massive overuse of water. We do have to have government regulation on how that is used, especially groundwater.
Well, we've been talking about India so far, but I know that agricultural workers in Europe have also been demonstrating in recent weeks. I'm wondering whether those protests in those different parts of the world, are they related in any way?
Yeah, so there are farmers' protests in Europe as well. They're happening in Poland, France, Spain, Italy, Greece, just to name a few. The farmers there are protesting against cheap food imports, as well as EU climate policies that are meant to make farming more sustainable. So things like reducing the use of pesticides and livestock farming, which the farmers say will just drive up their costs. The EU has actually watered down some of these regulations already, but farmers are still not happy. And while they are facing rising costs and accumulating a lot of debt too, these countries are obviously a lot more affluent than India. And the European farmers' demands are quite different from what farmers in India are asking for. But Jayati Ghosh does see one similarity.
I think all of these farmers are really saying the same thing, that we want to do ecologically desirable and, you know, good practices, but we don't want to bear the entire burden of doing that ourselves. That is something that benefits society as a whole. We are providing you the most essential aspect of human life. You must provide us the basic conditions that allow us to flourish as well.
I have no doubt that that is a sentiment that resonates with many farmers all over the world. Vivian Luck, thank you.
You're welcome.
And for our next story, we're sticking with the importance of farming, food, and climate, but we're jumping from India to our CBC Vancouver studio. you brought food today.
I did bring food. I did. And I'm so excited.
Oh, you're not the only one. Now, you've got to love a guest who brings food to her interview. That is our youth climate action columnist, Aishwarya Bhutur. She's a student at UBC, and she's just back from a trip home to Waterloo, where she saw her mother, who sent her home with food, of course. Food that she was kind enough to share with me.
So I brought mango chutney.
Oh, I love mango chutney.
And I also...
I'm getting little tingles.
And I also brought a traditional South Indian dish. Actually, the mango chutney is very South Indian as well.
Yes, yeah.
But this is like traditional. My mom made it fresh yesterday.
Okay, my mouth is watering now. Come on over here. Okay. Let's try this.
But you can put this... Mm. Mm.
Okay. That is so good. Okay, we like to check in with Aishwarya regularly to find out what young people in the climate movement are doing. And this time she's talking about youth working on food sovereignty. That is, projects that support people's right to healthy, culturally appropriate food that is produced in a sustainable way. Oh my goodness, before we go on, I should say, Aishwarya Bhutur, welcome back to What on Earth?
Thank you, very excited.
You haven't just brought food for the fun of it, although I thank you for that. You actually wanted to talk about food and climate change today. And this is actually a subject that's personal for you because farming's in your family background, right?
It is, yes, yes. So I come from a line of farmers, both on my mom's side and my dad's side.
And were they farmers as well?
No, not my parents, okay. But they grew up with watching either their grandparents or their parents farming. And I always tell people that my very first connection to sustainability comes from the stories that my mother told me. Mm-hmm. And growing up, there was never the term sustainability attached to it, right? But these are just stories of her like being on the land, foraging for flowers, for decorations. Sometimes they would take the dried leaves that they would get after farming and they would make cutlery out of it. And this cutlery they would either sell or use. Yeah.
Wow. And does your mom still, I know that they weren't in farming, but does mm-hmm. she grow food now?
She does grow food, actually. She loves having a garden. I believe that this is almost her way of trying to connect with her past and her land that she's so far away from, right? She would often try to grow plants that are from India here. So like green veggies, like Indian green veggies.
How'd that go?
One was successful. One was successful. The others, not so much. Now she grows plants that actually grow here. But, you know, at the beginning when we first started gardening, that's what she would try to do to try and bring back a little bit of what she knew.
That's so understandable, that connection, which shows food is about culture as much as anything else. But this whole idea of farming and sustainability and food and climate change on today's show, we are also talking about the farmer protests that are happening right now in India, that farmers who are fighting to protect their livelihoods in the face of climate change. I'm wondering, in light of your own family history, what kind of stuff does that bring up for you?
To me, my journey with food sovereignty is a journey of reconciling with these stories of my ancestors who were farmers, because I grew up knowing more brand names than I ever did knowing plants, right? Yeah. I cannot walk on the streets and look at trees and tell you what their names are. But my mother can. And I remember, like, when every time we'd go to India, we'd be walking. And she'd be like, oh, yeah, that's that, that's that. I'm like, how do you know this? Because it saddens my heart to say this, but I could not tell the difference between two plants, two trees at least. I can tell, like, the main difference, like an oak tree and a pine, you know.
Right.
But I can't tell the very details of it. And I feel like it's because to me, and especially to the people of my generation at least, food was a commodity until I realized it was not. And it was only until I got into the climate movement. And actually within the climate movement, we've also had a lot of organizers from India who have been involved with the farmers' protests as well. So talking to them and just being involved in this community made me realize that food is not just what we buy at grocery stores, but it's what's rather grown on the very soil we stand on. Food is a part of us, and we're a part of food because the earth is a part of us, and we're a part of the earth. I do have to say, like, the farmers' protests and being involved with the climate movement, and also the stories that my mother has taught me, has allowed me to try and be on this journey of reconciling, which after moving into uni and having a kitchen of my own, I've been exploring even more.
Good. Good to hear. Now, yeah. You are in your first year of university, or uni, as you say. How are you seeing other young activists getting more involved with food on campus?
With food on campus, we have this place called Sprouts on campus at UBC, and it's this free food space, right? They always have a community kitchen, so you can go and get free meals.
Oh.
And to me, that is a testimony to food sovereignty in itself, because what is food sovereignty? It's affordable, it's accessible, and it's a localized source of farming and produce that every single person should have access to.
Is that food being grown on campus as well?
Yeah, there's actually a garden on campus, but I know that all of the food that they use is very localized as well.
Oh,
yeah,
that's a great idea.
Yeah.
Have you eaten there?
I have eaten there, actually. And? It was good. It was great. It was great. They don't always have community kitchens. Like, it's like weekly. Okay. But when it's not weekly, it's incredibly affordable. Like, that is the one place on campus that I know that anyone can go to, and it is very, very affordable.
That's important, really.
Mm-hmm.
So let's pull back a little bit more.
Mm-hmm.
A friend of yours is involved in a food project at the University of Guelph. Mm-hmm. Tell me about what the purpose of that is.
Yeah, absolutely. So my friend, her name is Laura Lesding, and she's working on a restoration project through the University of Guelph, and it's essentially on Manoomin. So Manoomin is this wild rice. It's culturally, spiritually, economically, and nutritionally important to the Anishinaabe peoples. And what essentially happened was, because of settler changes to the Winnipeg River, it's caused Manoomin, which is the wild rice, to decline drastically. And so their entire project is working on how can they ensure this restoration, and they're working with the peoples of the Nisga'an and Anishinaabe Nation to be able to do this. And they're studying Manoomin, and they're restoring it in a very culturally appropriate way. When I talked to her about it, she was so excited, and she was telling me about this project, and I didn't know that restoration projects, especially of like native food, was happening here on Turtle Island. And so when I got to know, I was like, well, this is another sign of food sovereignty, right? This is exactly what we need.
That's not the only youth-led food project that's caught your eye. Tell me about Nurture, which is in Waterloo. What's that program doing?
Okay, I'm so excited about Nurture as well, because Nurture is from where I'm from Waterloo. So Nurture is a program that Sri Ranjani, who is another incredible climate organizer, she's actually from South India as well, and she's an international student. She was trying to get a job for a co-op. And they gave her a whiteboard marker and a whiteboard, and they told her, how do you think food can be sustained locally, especially in the Waterloo region? Just figure out a project. And she did it. And that's the project that they put out.
Wow.
And it's Nurture, yeah. And so essentially what Nurture is that it is a gardening program for youth. So they started with 3 high schools. They started with a budget of $1,500, and now they're at 20. And it's been 2 years. And the whole point of this is to address the lack of access to healthy food, poor food literacy rates, poor mental health from a lack of meaningful connection to the land. And now Sri Ranjani has passed this project on to the city of Waterloo, actually. So the region is taking care of it.
What kinds of food are they growing?
They're growing everything. They're growing tomatoes, they're growing some green veggies. And then what they do with these is that either the kids are allowed to take it home, and then the rest they go and sell it at the farmer's market.
I should just say that for people who may not understand the term, food literacy is something you were talking about earlier, which is understanding where food comes from and not just thinking it's something that appears in the store, right?
Exactly.
Okay. You've spoken with a few of the people who are involved in all of these projects. What are you hearing from other young activists about why they are so interested in sustainable food projects right now?
I think it's the dignity to food, right? This concept of understanding that food, at the end of the day, it should not be a commodity. It should not be something that we have to pay money to get. The access to food is a dignity that every single human being should have. As organizers, as young people, we've consistently been talking about the importance of like basic human needs and ensuring that, especially within the climate movement. And so for youth, it's about everyone should know how to grow their own food, because we've grown up not knowing how to do that. And it's also about understanding that the more local the food, the more sustainable our food systems are going to be.
Which is how it links into climate change.
Exactly, exactly. Sriranjani, who is, again, the founder of the Nurture Program, she was telling me how when she grew up in India, she had always eaten seasonal vegetables and seasonal fruits. And so when she moved here, every time she walks into a grocery store, she's still surprised by the fact that you can have avocados from Guatemala and at any season, because for her, that was never a thing. And again, obviously, it's an incredible privilege to have access to different foods from different places at all times. But that is the whole point of sustainable food systems, is that localized, sustainably sourced food will be the best way for us to ensure we tackle emissions from the agricultural industry and ensure that we're making this greener and just world.
Right, because all of those other foods that are out of season usually come from far away on a plane.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, okay. So, Aishwarya, we've already talked about your newfound interest in cooking, but with all of this talk of growing food, I'm wondering, are you considering getting your hands dirty doing some gardening this summer?
I actually am. So I'm heading to India July and August.
Wow, great.
Yeah, and I'm very, very excited. And I'm hoping that I can visit some of the farms that my ancestors have worked on. Yeah, I'm very excited to be able to visit those lands and hopefully be able to help in. I do think that it will be an important part in my journey to understand food sovereignty even more, because I'm still in the process of doing that as well.
Aishwarya Patur, nice to see you again. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you so much.
It's always so great to hear from Aishwarya when she can find the time for us. She has got a lot on her plate these days with a full university schedule, and she's got a new part-time contract with Environment and Climate Change Canada, where she's helping the ministry develop a national framework on climate education. And we've got time now for a few more climate stories in the news this week. Quebec has now joined provinces signaling an earlier start to the wildfire season. The province's Fire Monitoring Agency recently issued a warning for some areas, and that is the earliest warning in its history. Alberta also declared last month that its wildfire season had started 10 days early. And BC issued a notice saying it was monitoring holdover fires from last year. If you missed it, take a listen back to our podcast from a couple of weeks ago. It's called So Long Winter, Hello Wildfires. A First Nation in BC is taking part ownership of a new natural gas pipeline project in the northwestern part of the province. The Nisga Nation is working with Texas-based Western LNG. The project aims to transport natural gas from northeastern BC to a site north of the coastal city of Prince Rupert. The same proposed pipeline was scrapped in 2017, partly due to falling prices for LNG. The president of the Nisga elected government is praising the deal as a new era for Indigenous participation in the Canadian economy. But other First Nations leaders and environmental activists are worried about the impact of the project on climate change. Okay, that is a special sound you're hearing there. It's one that could mean less drilling for oil and gas in the United States. It's the greater sage grouse, and the sound is courtesy of California's Bureau of Land Management. And what you're hearing is part of the male bird's mating dance, and I would also advise you to go and have a look at it online. It's quite something. In a move to try and protect the species, the Biden administration is proposing to limit drilling for fossil fuels, mining, and livestock grazing across much of the U.S. West. Conservationists say the bird species was once so huge, their flocks of millions darken the sky. The population is now estimated to be about 200,000. The government proposal, though, could also hinder the development of wind and solar power, along with mining for so-called critical minerals. Now, in Canada, the greater sage grouse is listed as an endangered species. A recent report says the bird is close to being extinct on the prairies. And of course, you can read more about climate change in the CBC What on Earth newsletter. You can subscribe to have it delivered to your inbox every week. Remember, you can listen to all of our episodes on demand at CBC Listen, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please leave us a review. That's all for us this week. The show was put together by Vivian Luck, Rachel Sanders, Molly Siegel, Missy Johnson, Matthias Wolfson, and Catherine Rolfson. And special thanks this week to Allison Cole. I'm Laura Lynch. Thank you for listening.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.